Welcome to Mindcrime, Dobson and Patton on Liberty. With me, Swithin Dobson.
And me, Tim Patton.
For our first episode, we will be discussing coronavirus. So, Tim, what do you think on this?
So I'm going to break down the case for skepticism. I was skeptical of this from the start. I figured it would eventually come to the United States once it was in China. So I was skeptical of what China did and whether or not that actually saved it from the coronavirus. And I knew it would eventually come to the United States. But what I was totally bewildered about was the response that the United States and Britain has had to this virus. I'm not skeptical of the existence of the virus. I am somewhat skeptical of its origins, but that is largely a non-issue for me, the two competing conspiracy theories. The only salient fact there is undermines trust in the government and its health organizations, which would then in turn undermine the response that people have, the faith in the response that they have. But what I'm mainly skeptical about is A, the severity / mortality of it, and B, what exactly the drastic action will do, and of course, the opportunity costs of it all. One of the reasons why I'm a libertarian is opportunity costs. One of the problems I have with most alarmists in any field is, and of any political stripe, is there's certain problems which don't in principle have any solution. We saw China had a solution, which is to lock down the whole region. But what did that actually save them? Peter Hitchens had a great story about someone who got the chicken pox. So they went to the doctor and they said, oh, we'll just cut off your leg. Well, the chicken pox is gone. But, you know, you have another case of a person who has chicken pox. They didn't cut off their leg. And they're also gone. They also, 2 months later, both patients, neither of them have chicken pox. The surgeon says, look how cutting his leg off did save them from chicken pox. Now, I think in a lot of ways, that may or may not be the case of this. Because the 1.7 million death toll, will that happen in the United States? That's 2 months ago, White House advisors, I think Fauci, came over that number. So that's the extreme death toll. This is a quite draconian reaction. It meets all the qualifications. And one of the problems I have with social distancers is if the social distancing requires everyone to work, that's insane. That's what Thomas Sowell would call the unrestrained view. There's going to be people that have to get out. There's going to be people that are going to flout the rules. Even China had people flout the rules. So let alone much freer societies like the United States and Britain. And worse still, it could be, and I've seen some reports, that having everyone at home might make things worse. So that's a sort of general overview of my thoughts onto this crisis. And I want you, Swithin, to start breaking down the data of the UK and the US.
Okay, so the current death toll in the USA is currently reported to be about 22,000 people, crucially dying, whether with or of coronavirus we'll get to later. Current death toll is about 22,000, and the now estimate from Fauci is around 60,000 deaths in the US, down from his millions earlier predictions. This is in contrast to, if you want to compare it with the previous large pandemic, which was Spanish flu in 1918, according to the CDC, in the US, 675,000 people died. So that's about how many died in that one, although the population of the US was significantly lower than only about 100 million as opposed to about 330 million. So if it was as bad as Spanish flu was in the US, that would kill around 4 million people, taking into account the population changes. In the UK, our current death toll is 10,612. and the estimated deaths of coronavirus is expected to be between 7,000 and 20,000 following the current lockdown procedures. And this is from Neil Ferguson, who is the single most important man in England for this, who headed up the imperial model, which had a worst case scenario of deaths of 500 and something thousand people, which is credited within the media as the main reason why we went into lockdown mode. Prior to this, we'd had just some social distancing and most things had remained open. But it's this guy's modelling which has led to this change. So again, just with the Spanish flu comparison, Britain was reported to have 228,000 deaths as a result of the Spanish flu, taking the UK population to be about 42 million, which is from the 1911 census. That gives a death rate of the population of about 0.5%. Now, not everybody in the country would have got it for herd immunity to come up to basically kill it. Because if someone gets it, but they can't pass it on to anybody else, it's not really going to get around. So assuming about an 80% assuming an 80% infection rate, broadly speaking, that makes an infection fatality rate of 0.7%. For Spanish flu in 1918. This is compares with the infection fatality rate estimated by the imperial modelers of Neil Ferguson of about 0.9%. So they actually estimated the coronavirus deaths to be coronavirus to be more virulent and lethal than the Spanish flu. So that gives you a general view of the more mainstream modelling and the ones which seemingly the government is taking most account of when it's coming in with its responses.
Well, there seems to be two groups of epidemiologists here. We have the mainstream ones, Fauci and Neil Ferguson, and we also have the more heretical ones, the John Leonidas guy, and then some other ones, of course. And also as a country-by-country approach, or in the United States, we have to a certain extent a county-by-county and city-by-city approach and state-by-state approach. We also have a variety of social distancing measures done at a variety of different times. California was one of the first states to enact the stay-at-home order. In the East Coast, some of the cities did it. Some towns in Georgia and some towns in Washington enacted quite almost European-level stay-at-home orders. But mostly throughout the United States, we've had a very compared to places like Italy, the United States have very relatively mild things. And to a certain extent, that follows United States' federalism. So I can see what Britain adopted almost entirely Neil Ferguson's advice. Do you know of any reason why Germany or Sweden have adopted a more mild approach, more mirroring the United States, Swithin?
Well, Germany is still reasonably strong, although maybe not as strong as other countries. So, for example, two of the most outspoken of the non-mainstream dissenting epidemiologists actually come both from Germany, Knut Witkowski and Sukarit Bhakti. The latter has written an open letter to Angela Merkel saying how this is going to destroy people's lives in Germany, and how elderly people are being their quality of life is just being completely stripped away because they can no longer have any human contact anymore. Knut Witkowski basically says it's just like any other flu. You just let it happen. Everyone gets it. It's a bit crazy for 4 weeks and then it dies down. So he's very much of the view that, you know, you just leave it alone. John Ioannidis has been more critical of the stats, but he's never said anything on policy. Wieckowski is retired, so he doesn't care. I'm not sure about Bacchetti, but I suspect John Ioannidis is maybe wanting to keep his job, possibly. But as to respect to Sweden, Sweden's politicians basically don't want to lock things down. They currently ban any gatherings of over 50 people, but everywhere is pretty much open. I think one of the reasons for this possibly is Sweden's population density is relatively low, which means that the speed at which people will catch it is probably quite low. I wouldn't be surprised if you run the numbers that there's a correlation between population density and the and how hard any of the lockdown procedures are. You'd have to be careful with that because France is stronger than the UK's, but France has a lower population density. But the problem is there's lots of places in France where literally nobody lives. So you'd have to kind of be a little bit more nuanced as to where you counted people actually living. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case.
One of the main issues I have with this, and this is sort of mirrors of why I'm somewhat sympathetic to sort of Austrian, quite frank, anti-empirical work, is that there's huge numbers of variables, and I think you would agree with me here, there's huge numbers of variables that go into each country's data. And one of the problems I have is, will we ever know if the alarmist cases are correct, even if we think that social distancing works, and even if we think that that draconian social distancing works, and even if we can trust, and we'll get in this late in a little bit, if we can trust the death tolls and the infection rates, which I, again, even if we can trust those two or three things, it's a big if, will we ever even know? I'm just certainly skeptical about whether we even know if these things work. My guess is the politicians will declare victory regardless of the death toll. And that's one of the things that they've been somewhat squirrely on. I was reading the comments section under Richard Epstein, who came out. Richard Epstein did rule number one. He's a libertarian of some kind. He works for the Hoover Institute. He had a Reason magazine article about a month or two ago. And it was an interview. He said, I think in the U.S. it'll kill, I think he said either 5,000 or 15,000. So Richard Epstein was wrong. But what's also worth pointing out is that Fauci and some of the other people estimated to kill 1.7 million. The actual estimate now is like 60,000. So in that regard, if you look at the estimation error, Richard Epstein's much closer with his back of an envelope prediction than the dream team at the White House. And I would assume Neil Ferguson's alarmist figure will also come up as much lower than them. So in that way, do you agree in general that to a certain extent we might not ever know of whether this works or doesn't work?
No, you won't, because the standard by which you need to compare it is a counterfactual situation, and by definition, the counterfactual situation never existed. So it's all going to depend on what do you think the assumptions of your sort of counterfactual situation are. And it's almost certain that those who support the heavy-handed approach and the lockdown will claim that, well, you know, all these catastrophic things would have taken place. I mean, you could try to do it to some extent. I mean, it would be interesting to see what the modelling would be like in 2 years' time, because in 2 years' time, you should have decent numbers to work with, well, significantly better than they are at present. So it would be interesting to see some modelling in a couple of years to see, OK, if we hadn't done anything, what would have been the likely death toll, given that we know everything now? although you'd have to take into account that they wouldn't necessarily know how best to treat patients. So you might want to factor in what the information was at the time. So you might be able to do it, but it's almost certainly going to come to the situation that nobody is ever going to be convinced by, quote unquote, the evidence. It's going to go into the what are the more plausible assumptions of how you produce the model. That's where the interest is going to be, not with the numbers themselves.
All right, well, let's go into what you thought was the main issue, which I'm going to ask you this question, is the number of asymptomatic cases plus the mild unrecorded ones. I've been skeptical of the denominator of this problem because there's reports in Iceland of a large percentage of people being asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, I think is the updated term to call it. And plenty of people, you know, get all sorts of other things that are related to flu, and they're going to say symptoms as well of that. So there's a huge, this somewhat relates with the do we ever know, because the death rate to me is very, and I think this is true, the death rate is very dependent on the total number of people that they have. So what's your thoughts here on the first main issue of the asymptomatic cases, Swithin?
Yeah, so just to say about the death rate, what they typically will use is you'll see a case fatality rate, death, which is a recorded case. And what you'll do is you'll then put the number of people who died on the top divided by the number of people they know had a case of a particular illness, which, of course, depends largely, well, not entirely, for reasons we'll get into later, on the denominator to determine how large it is. Because if there's lots of people who actually have it but aren't recorded of having it, then it makes the disease look significantly more dangerous than it actually is. So the problem with knowing what this case is the tests that have used are, from what I have read, at least until recently, have been rather unreliable. They give both false positives and false negatives. And so it's actually quite difficult to know, even if the tests they have done are vaguely accurate. But there was a study done in Iceland, which tested a relatively large proportion of the population, but still rather small, and found that of the people who contracted coronavirus, 50% of those who tested positive were entirely asymptomatic, and nearly 50% of them had very mild symptoms. It was only a very small proportion, in the 0.something% of the people who were tested, actually had any particularly bad symptoms at all. Now, the numbers you're talking here are quite small, because actually most of the people they tested didn't actually have it in Iceland. But the problem with, I don't know in the case of the US, but certainly in the UK, we've only ever been testing people who have basically been near hospitals. And a lot of people, they've been told, if you think you have coronavirus, stay at home. Well, unless they're going to say, if you've run, because in the UK, we have a non-emergency number to ring for medical advice. And unless they're noting down people who are ringing up and sound like they have coronavirus as a case, which I don't think they are, then there's lots of people who probably have it, but aren't recording of having it. In addition to this, there's quite a few people anecdotally have argued they had a particularly nasty sort of viral disease before Christmas, which people have potentially considered coronavirus actually got to the UK earlier than had been originally suggested. But until there is wide-scale testing with tests which are accurate, then there's absolutely no way of knowing what the infection fatality rate actually is. And just to finish on this, a recent study of a certain German town is actually found by a guy called Hendrik Streeck, who is a virologist, has actually found that he thinks the lethality of COVID-19 for those infected is actually 0.37%. So let's round it to 0.4%, which is less than half the fatality rate as estimated by Neil Ferguson.
So I just want to break this down. If you have 1,000 people, what's the number that, if you don't know offhand, that's fine, but what's the number that would have coronavirus, and what's that'd be about 5 deaths, correct? 5 deaths per 1,000?
If all of them have coronavirus, Neil Ferguson reckons 9%, 9 of them would die, and Hendrik Streeck reckons it'd be 4.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be basically
of 1,000 people with the virus. And have they come up with any what percentage of the society of any given area has it? Because have they tried to do something like that where they try to get a guess? Because that, to me, the denominator itself of the broader population, which is where we're going to get into the idea of herd immunity, which is the alternate solution, depends entirely on the total number of people get it. Because some of the more draconian alarmist prediction predict if 80% of people get it. So what's the numbers there, Swithin, from what you've been reading?
It varies to different places. As you say, nobody knows because no one's done wide-scale testing. So they don't actually have any idea. I've heard estimates from between like 15 and maybe 30% in certain cases, but it's kind of throwing a dart in the dark. Because, as I said, without widespread testing, there is no way of knowing how many people actually have it. And the problem as well is being able to generalize, because if you get a particular rate in a city in particular, then you could potentially overestimate it because you might think that people living in cities are more likely to transmit it to other people, particularly if you're in apartment blocks and you've got recircled like air and things.
Yeah, that's one of the frustrating thing about this, because that's one of the frustrating things about the mainstream, and I'll call them the debunkers, is the mainstream to a certain extent refuses to own up on the uncertainty here regarding what they're doing. And that's one of the reasons I like Peter Hitchens' coverage. Peter Hitchens, I think, is fairly agnostic over the actual data, but the mainstream has been quite and to a certain extent more so in Britain. The United States has adopted a much more mild policy because there's uncertainty about the virus itself and its origin. There's uncertainty about the number of testing. There's uncertainty about the fatality. And this was also frustrating, is the actual cause of death. And this is your third question here, is your cause of death. You have most people who die of this already have some pre-existing conditions. There, of course, are some cases of people that out of the blue get it and die and are perfectly healthy. But there's most people who die of this are older, from my understanding, already have pre-existing conditions. And if that is the case, then we have 5 things happening. You have 5 injuries. What's necessary and sufficient is you have to have at least 4 of them. So you have to have respiratory problems to begin with. You have to be somewhat old. And then this cuts down on the general alarmist thing. So I think one of Richard Epstein's suggestions was just people who are sick, just self-isolate. Nursing homes, just self-isolate them. And that's another problem I have with the sort of mainstream, quote-unquote, debunkers. They sort of get into this sort of one question, do you believe in science or not? And I'm like, which scientists, which epidemiologists, which social? So to me, we should have a menu of options available, and it should be respectable to hold a menu of positions, not just the most extreme one. Because you could also argue the extreme position is not extreme enough, because there are elephant-sized holes in the social distance policy. So what are your overview of my comments there on, because it is quite clear that there's most of the people that die already have pre-existing conditions. And again, this is very sad. As Peter Hitchens would point out, it's very sad that Boris got it. Is Boris a paradigm of health? Maybe not. So what are your thoughts there?
The Yeah, you're right. The median age of deceased in most countries is over 80. Now, of course, you don't really want them to die, you know, fine. And it is true. And as ever, most of them did have pre-existing conditions. I think in Italy, over half of the deceased had at least three underlying medical conditions. Now, it is to note that about 1% don't have any previous medical illnesses. However, I suspect that is more likely to be undiagnosed illnesses, because you have cases where, well, there was a famous case. You might not know this. There was a footballer. Well, actually, it happened a couple of times, actually. The most famous one was a Cameroonian footballer, Marc Vivien Foe, who was playing football and then died of a heart attack because he had almost certainly a heart defect. But it was undiagnosed. So even if these people are dying, oh no, we could kill them. It's like, well, even if they didn't have a diagnosed underlying condition, it doesn't follow from that they didn't have an underlying condition. Because one recent footballer who was a youth team player, I think he's like 18, something like that, he went to hospital in Spain and they realized, oh, he actually had leukemia. And then he died. And so it was probably more the leukemia than the coronavirus. But the biggest problem with, oh, all these people are dying, etc., it's like, people die all the time. And the problem with most of the media coverage, and it's the media who I blame the most for just giving people no information, any usable information at all, is to figure out how bad this is. We need to compare it with what's normal. And let's assume that our general response to death is the correct. Now, which it could be wrong, but we want to have a baseline to compare it with. We need to know what that comparison is, because at the moment everyone just sees coronavirus deaths constantly and assumes that we're going to having like mass graves.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, person dies in the United States, 7,500 people in 2018, 7,500 people die every day in the United States, and that's about one every 12 seconds. So I would assume Britain divided by roughly six or seven would have similar numbers as well. I think about 1,500 die every day. So it's not like, you know, we have to start from a starting point. And on the news, they always have that people today died of coronavirus. And to me, that number needs to be unpacked. So I think you would agree.
Yeah, it just makes no sense. There's no context provided at all. And just with context, a recent paper done by John Ioannidis, I can't pronounce his name, it's kind of Greek. He said that the probability of death for those under the age of 65 was basically the same risk as it is driving 9 miles in Germany. To which you go, is it worth driving 9 miles? Yes, it is.
Exactly.
Let's go out then. I mean, the ridiculous thing is, and this is actually a general thing that the government does as a whole, he tends to have an absurd one-size-fits-all policy. It's not targeted in any way. The death rates of anybody over the age of 80 is significantly higher than it is under the age of 65. I don't have those figures quite to hand just at the moment. But like, you've got to take into account like who you actually are, not you as a generic person, because you as a generic person, well, the generic person doesn't exist. The average person doesn't exist. You need to take into account, you know, your specific circumstances, which the government policies just simply haven't really taken into account.
Yeah, I want to get into a quick drop one of the more alarmists recently on this, Nassim Taleb. Nassim Taleb floats in a lot of libertarian circles, but Nassim Taleb came out really hard on the alarmist side early on Twitter, and he's also published a number of papers. I actually in general like a lot of what Nassim Taleb, at least the old Nassim Taleb, the black swan, anti-fragile Nassim Taleb, I think a lot of libertarians did as well, but he's taken his precautionary principle, and this sort of relates with the government, the precautionary principle, and he sort of amplified it to the most alarmist level. And this is where the driving 9 miles in a German road problem. This is where you cross. This is where you have risks of all sorts of things. Every day you have risks. You could get hit by a car. You could hit by a bus. You could trip and fall. You can have an infected cut. There's all sorts of other things that could die. And this is where I think we have to get into the opportunity costs. We have one more issue here, but can you just comment on Nassim Taleb? Because he's been one of the most outspoken, and they're really taking this precautionary principle seriously. And this is where I think it's getting really dodgy, because there's all these other risks out there.
Yeah, my issue. Yeah, I listened to a little bit of Taleb on this, his basic view seems to be that if things go badly, then things going bad are significantly worse than things going good. Therefore, we need to weight more heavily the bad, which is fine, which is understandable. I mean, a good example he uses, at least when you're looking at averages, is done in the past. If you say, oh, the average temperature was like, I don't know, 18 degrees C, or I don't know, is that 60 something in
Yes.
Fahrenheit?
Yeah, 68 or
It's
so.
like, well, we need to look at the standard deviation, because if that's gone to like minus 40 at one point, and like up to like 80 or 90 Fahrenheit, or maybe like 200 Fahrenheit at some point over time, it's like, I'm pretty sure you're going to be dead. So the fact you're looking at the average is kind of irrelevant. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But the problem with Taylor's view is it just simply doesn't take into account the opportunity cost. It just doesn't just seems to not to factor into his analysis in any way, shape, or form. It's like, oh, okay, if we do this, what is all the negative stuff that's going to happen?
Exactly.
And then all the other deaths and stuff. It's just not really there. But just with the deaths, this is my third point. Well, I have another one as well. Another issue with coronavirus is determining whether you died of coronavirus or whether you just had coronavirus. Because if I have coronavirus and I'm driving my car that 9 miles in Germany, and I happen to like run some, I'm about to like crash into a bridge or something and then die, well, I had coronavirus. Well, did I die of coronavirus? No. Of course, they didn't die of coronavirus. So the question arises as well: is it's the classic, because of, or in spite of, or just irrelevant point? It's like, well, you had it, but did you die of it? Well, or because of it? We don't really know.
Yeah. And there's just a huge amount of uncertainty on this. There's a huge amount of uncertainty throughout this. So, question number four, your statement number four. So, this is the motive for the lockdown, from my understanding, is that we had to flatten the curve. And the reason we had to flatten the curve was to treat coronavirus, we need ventilators. Well, it turns out a large number of the patients on ventilators die anyway. This, to me, being a skeptic, would immediately made me question, why do we do this draconian policy to begin with if ventilators was one of the chief shortages? So if you could touch on that, Swithin, for a minute, and then we'll move on to the state action.
So so ventilators basically take over breathing. I think they compress the lungs. I'm not sure on the exact technical details, but they basically breathe for you, and they can do some lots of damage to your lungs as well, actually. And it is true that they will only use them in rare cases, well, relatively bad cases. But from at least American doctors, the best way of treating the coronavirus is actually the anti-malarial drug, and that has the best response, and plus doesn't have the negative the downsides that ventilation does. So if it transpires that ventilators aren't actually the best course of action, at least in most cases, it might work in some cases, but at least not a great proportion of the serious cases, then one of the major reasons for the lockdown simply is unjustified. It would seem otherwise that just like a standard oxygen provision would be perfectly fine. So that's what Boris Johnson had. He was never put on a ventilator. He was just given oxygen. which I'm pretty sure is just a case of getting a canister of oxygen and putting a mask over your face.
Exactly.
Which is significantly easier to produce than a ventilator, which I'm pretty sure is quite a sophisticated piece of kit. And just back on, before we move on, well, I found my number. In Italy, according to a professor, Walter Ricciardi, who I think I pronounced it right, who's a scientific advisor to Italy's Ministry of Health, basically stated that of the people they said have died of coronavirus, or with coronavirus, only 12% of them actually died of coronavirus. And Italy has been used as one of the countries to go...
it's one of the alarmist countries. Yes. It's one of the alarmist countries to paint the most dire scene possible to justify more lockdown in the United States. Because Italy was one of the first to lock down its population.
And just the thing on Italy, and this is the problem with comparing between countries, there's great differences in age of population, general health, also air quality. So in northern Italy, they have lots of smog, and they've always had bad problems with winter flus. And in many cases, I believe they've had overrun hospitals on bad flu bouts historically. So the fact that they had some problems in a few hospitals, not all of them, note, not all the hospitals in Lombardy had a problem. It was in specific areas. Well, it might be slightly worse than it had before, but it's certainly not unprecedented in the case of Italy. So you have this big problem of estimating like general conditions and average age, not just average age, you want specific numbers of people in a particular age group. So using figures from different countries is more difficult to compare. And again, we don't even, there could be an ethnic difference as to how this is affects people. So because in England, they've been complaining, oh, ethnic minority groups have been disproportionately affected, which immediately is probably due to the fact they more likely live in cities, and so the population density is greater. But, you know, there could be an ethnic, again, nobody actually knows.
Yeah, this is one of the frustrating things about the media and the sort of social distance advocates and all these people is it's uncertainty times uncertainty times uncertainty. And then this is the opportunity cost. And I think the opportunity cost, because if you're going to count up the lives saved, if you want to argue there's lives saved, which may or may not be the case. It's worth pointing out, though, when they announced these policies, and I think this goes to Thomas Sowell's point about constrained versus unconstrained. When they announced these policies, one of the first things many people do when they announce that there's going to be a lockdown is go travel or go out, go to the store. And that was one of the things. So Trump, a while back, announced his China ban and later announced his Europe ban, which put everyone in lines in airports. So, again, if you want to buy into the logic of social distancing, you have to assume that people are going to follow through with it. And if it's going to be social distancing starts in 24 hours, which is generally how they announce it, that's how the policy gets announced. The next 24 hours, most people will go out like crazy, which is normal. You have to prepare. So this would be like the incubation time period. So with every policy, this reminds me of Brian Kaplan's not only null test, it's his negative test, is if you have a policy and you think it's going to help people, you better not only check the null hypothesis, you better check the negative hypothesis. That's one of the things I'm very suspicious of. Because if people like Fauci want to argue that we would have killed 1.7 million people, maybe if we didn't have, this is pure speculation, but as Richard Epstein, a little common fight that Richard Epstein had, this is equally speculative. And if you look at who makes the bigger number error in quantity, it's the alarmists by far. So again, we're probably never going to know. But let's talk about our certainties about state action. And this is where it gets frustrating. This is a quite draconian policy. It's much more draconian in Britain. Some of these local states are running 50% already, or like well over the deficit of their last year. I think the United States is going to run something like a $5 trillion deficit. And of course there'll be a bailout. But as any libertarian knows, this is just a money printing operation. This is monopoly money. Peter Hitchens knows this as well. There's going to be huge deficits. There's also a huge loss to the real economy. This is 2 months where a lot of people who are quote unquote unessential are just out of work. In the hospital in the United States, plenty of hospitals have laid off staff. non-elective surgeries aren't going on. And a lot of non-elective surgery, non-essential surgeries are quite essential. Things like physical therapy, many people aren't allowed to do that now. Things like house repair, and moving out of there, things like house repair, design and development of other things, cancer drugs, and all these things. So these are huge state actions. We have the deficits, we have the lost opportunity costs, and this is all sandwiched by all the uncertainty. So what are some of the known costs that we have of the state action in Britain? I've outlined some of the deficits in the United States. What are some of the known costs we have in general and in the UK in particular?
Well, it's certainly the case that small and medium-sized businesses are going to be harmed the most, especially because the government aid that's coming in for them is only going to start coming in June. So they're going to have to sort of tide themselves over for the next couple of months. I haven't seen any unemployment figures for the UK or for the or GDP figures yet. I think they may come out in a month or so. But they're certainly going to be rocketing. I mean, the US figures for unemployment are absolutely astounding. The previous unemployment high recorded in the US was about 800,000. It's now close to 7 million. I mean, the unemployment is just astonishingly high. And this is going to harm the small and medium-sized business far more than anybody else. And a lot of people who would like to see what you might refer to as a more economically leftist policy are like, oh, this is good because it's kind of, showing the flaws of our current capitalist society. And, when we need to reduce consumption and stuff, I'm like, okay. I understand from their point of view, you've got these big, large corporations, and it's like they're doing less well. It's like, okay, I can understand to some extent why you wouldn't be too concerned about that. But they completely miss that still lots of the economy, however distorted it actually is, are small businesses putting food on the table for their own families. And they have basically been prevented from providing services for other people so that they can, feed themselves, basically. So just to say with the UK, we have, all shops are basically closed, apart from pharmacies and supermarkets. Lots of people have to basically work from home. Schools are closed. And you're basically only allowed to go outside for exercise or to get essential items. That's it. There's been certain police forces, particularly Derbyshire police, who have been very heavy-handed and seem to take great glee at stopping people and going, where are you going? And have you got a... hang on, what's this? This is whiskey. This is not an essential item. So the quantitative costs of the lockdown in the UK aren't yet apparent, but if this is not the biggest deficit on record as a proportion of GDP, I'm pretty sure the statisticians are lying.
Yeah, there's huge financial and there's huge non-financial costs. I mean, one of the things I got in sort of a comment war on one under the post was one of the things is plenty of old people are not allowed to see young people and vice versa. Yeah. I mean, you have senior citizens who are not allowed out of their house and no one's allowed to visit them. I mean, come on, 2 months. And what's also frustrating about the mainstream is for all their talk about the debunking and trust science, from their own interpretive models, in theory, we have to keep this on for at least 2 more months, if not 18 months till a vaccine. So again, every week this goes by, these costs add up. I mean, old people aren't allowed to see their grandchildren for a month. All right, they're not allowed to go to church for a month. Okay, that's fine. But 18 months, really? If you only live for 85 years, that's like 3% of your life. That's like something like 3% of your life. So 3% of your life, in the name of living longer, we're supposed to have people basically under house arrest. And this is where I think many of the social distancers people want it both ways. They want this to be a very draconian. They want everyone to stay at home, but they don't want to own up. They don't want to own up to the fact that they're forcing them to stay home with using shame or the police. United States is again had a very mild lockdown, but they sort of went it both ways because they either prove too much, they either prove that we actually don't have much of a lockdown, or they prove too little And they proved either they proved too much or they proved too little. So the costs are quite ginormous, and the quality of life costs are quite ginormous. Plenty of lost trips, plenty of lost weddings, plenty Easter canceled, lost church services, lost sporting events. Again, plenty of people say, oh, well, that's just consumerism. And then you look at the actual events. Okay, so is kids' sports consumerism or is that not? What does the left exactly want? Or what does people exactly want? Is kids' sports or is things like live music, is that filthy consumerism? That's apparently been deemed unnecessary. And I think that's quite sad on the quality of life aspects. I think telling senior citizens that they're not allowed out and no one's allowed to visit them is quite sad. At some point, and this is where we're going to get into the last section of this episode, is when do you think this will ever be justified in general? We're both libertarians. We're slightly different libertarians. I'm more of a consequentialist in this regard. So I'm willing, in theory, to at least ponder this analysis. Although your side has a few problems with, if you want to bring this up with the, is a person a weapon somehow? And that's one of the questions I've seen debated on a few libertarian subheadings in various places. But what do you think? Do you think this is ever justified? I'm skeptical. Say this is ever going to be justified. I'll give my answer. Is because A, as we discussed, does it really work? There's so much uncertainty. We don't know, and we might know in a few years. We might not. As David Friedman would say. What once was asked about, he had a skepticism toward climate change. He said, look, it's no guarantee that if every country elects a very hardcore Al Gore climate change alarmist and everyone elects it, there's no guarantee that it fixes it. The IPC may or may not agree. Check Bob Murphy on that. So I think a similar analysis is on this, is we have somewhat draconian lockdowns. Will they work? Will they not? And are they worth it? I would generally say they're very rarely justified. As Peter Hitchin said, a Martian invasion, maybe we should have a lockdown. But again, with the Martian invasion, that goes back to my example of David Friedman, is what would a lockdown do to stop us from a Martian invasion? It's just, we're just going to get run over by a Martian invasion. There are some things which are just in principle. There's no solution to the problem. There's just trade-offs. And as we just mentioned, the trade-offs are quite large. So I'm suspicious of that there being a quote-unquote solution. We've adopted a solution, a quite draconian one. So what's your thought on libertarianism, and is this ever justified?
Well, there was an interesting short article written about over 10 years ago now by Bob Murphy, on a libertarian approach to quarantine. And he takes the view that if you had a libertarian world where all land was held privately, then whether you could move on or off the property would be determined by the property owner. And it would be in the interests of the property owners not to allow infectious people on their property, well, because they would lose business. So, for example, Disneyland is not going to want someone who has the Ebola virus, for example, turning up in Disneyland because, people won't want to go there if they think they can get Ebola because they will die. So that's the basic claim. And so because of this, he argues that these businesses will take account of expert opinion of who's a risk and who's not. Maybe use some broad epidemiological figures, or he even considers potentially some sort of like you have a credit rating for your finances. You might have like a health infectious rating, although he doesn't go into how that would be collected because that could end up being somewhat invasive, but theoretically. And then businesses could decide whether they should let them on or not. And crucially, the difference in this world is, if one company is far more draconian than others, then they'll lose loads of business and not do very well. Somebody who's too lax will lose lots of business because people won't go there because they think they'll die. And the business which makes the appropriate decision based on the costs and the benefits is the one which will make the most profits and therefore will be the one that continues to exist, or at least does financially better. I have a couple of problems with this. The main one is the view that all land would be held privately. I don't even think. I think you're always going to have things like public thoroughfares, etc., where at least the ownership isn't
Yeah, they're
clearly.
pseudo. There may not be explicit commons, but they're at least pseudo commons. It's like it's like Main Street in Disney World, or it's like the interior of a parking garage or a mall. They're pseudo commons. They might not be explicit commons because they're not open to everybody, but they're
Well,
open to many people.
I'm thinking more specifically, you might have roads, for example. And let's suppose these roads were built on after people to have established rights of way of walking. I mean, even though it's kind of a private road, could they reasonably restrict anybody from walking down there? Because, oh, it's my road now, you need to pay something. Well, no, because you kind of built the road after my sort of great, 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 great grandfather started walking there. And so you could treat that as an inheritance, that they inherited the rights of way, as it were.
Yeah.
So
also,
malls would be slightly
also
different.
Another thing about, you know, sort of market generated law society is any law enforcement mechanism is going to be private. So unless you're engaging in outright theft, a lot of prevention methods are expensive. A lot of prevention methods are expensive, not in all circumstances. So if you want to prevent people from drinking alcohol or something like that, in theory, you could have a society where they do that. But it's going to require a huge amount of surplus value to be funneled into a prevention agency, you know, vice squads and so forth. So in a private law society, if things are done on the market, it could be that, and the David Friedman sort of discussed this in Legal Systems for Own and Private Law, and Murray Rothbard probably has similar, but yet different origins and first principles. So that's one of the benefits. But go back to your point regarding Bob Murphy. What was
okay? So with public thoroughfares, he has a problem. But just before I step back, Bob Murphy makes a very good point in the private actions of private property owners. Is with the current government anti-discrimination laws, if a firm decided that they wouldn't let you in because they thought you were infectious, but the government decided that they weren't, they could probably take you to court and sue you for discrimination. So that option isn't really open to private owners these days, because really the assumption is you have to trade with anybody who wants to trade, as it were, which is an old view of trade, for one thing. But that's how legally it's come since the Civil Rights Act in the US and the Race Relations Act in the UK. So you can't actually do that anymore. So I do think that's a strength of Bob Murphy's position, because I think that would solve problems to some extent. But with public thoroughfares, the question is, can you stop people from going on it? And I think what you would have to do is based on some broad common law principles. Is somebody in this area, are they an active threat? Is it equivalent to someone walking around with a trigger over a gun pointing it at some innocent people? Well, if so, and you have probable cause of doing so, then it doesn't seem unreasonable to force them to quarantine themselves. Now, how you do this without infecting the people who take him down, as it were, that's a technical problem. So that seems reasonable, in theory. But crucially, I think what you would have to say is, if the government or the other agent was wrong in incarcerating you for a number of days, so you couldn't infect anybody else, well, then that's false imprisonment, and therefore they are then liable for compensation. The issue with the government doing all this, they can make lots of costless decisions to themselves. They can go, oh, we'll just herd and round everybody up, assuming they have it. And it's like, well, if they don't, what you've done is you've imprisoned somebody for no reason. And I think adding these sort of common law principles in addition to Murphy's arguments would allow a level of practicality that you might not think it could take place, whilst retaining a potential response, which is sort of like enforced, but crucially is one where the full cost principle is applied, as opposed to the situation where effectively the government either doesn't pay for its costs or devolves them onto somebody else.
Yeah, what's frustrating about the general critiques of libertarians, the people who critique the libertarians, i.e. there's no libertarians in pandemics, is A, one theory
One theory is that in a private law society or in Capistan or whatever you want to call it, we have much more draconian things, which would maybe make you and I skeptical of libertarianism. But that should make our enemies libertarians. But our enemies don't turn into libertarians. Our enemies go back to their normal position. And your point about discrimination was spot on. Here's a classic case where now everyone's in, I mean, it's, they have these tracing apps, these draconian tracing surveillance apps that are possibly coming out. You know, these health chips, you can't go in. You can't go in if you haven't gotten tested. This is an extremely discriminatory policy. Again, so people like to paint these very scary hypotheticals, and you can sort of see it was the moon harsh mistress, but that's more of a positive side. Is they paint these extremely dangerous, scary, fearmonger thing. Private law society would be a sort of nightmare. But we basically more or less just privatized all the roads in the United States with very strict border patrol. And now we're going to implement the very stringent discrimination that we've seen in a while. So either our enemies should become libertarians or we should stop becoming libertarians. So what's your thoughts there, Smith?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is the greatest irony, is the people who have called for the most draconian lockdown in the world are the same people who would call Donald Trump and Boris Johnson fascists, and how bad they will be and they will oppress us all. And then these are the people who are then calling on Boris Johnson and Donald Trump to be as fascist as possible. It is an utterly bizarre world. Although what they actually think is probably they're not trying to give power to Trump and Johnson. What's quite obvious is how this has been handled in the US and the UK is that the motivation for a very hard lockdown response has really come from the elite bureaucracy and sort of the elite medical figures. And they're the ones with the power, and they force the hands of people. Because I don't think Johnson would have wanted to do very much at all, and Trump doesn't seem like he would have done either. This is a managerial elite response. And I think that's who the people in the media class and the left are really kind of wanting, because what they really want is some sort of technocratic, or even more technocratic society. And this is one of the means by which they can kind of, not necessarily create the totalitarian technocracy immediately, but it's a way of showing to people that they must follow the science and believe the experts. And of course, the experts are them, as opposed to anybody else. That's, you know, what they've been engaged in.
Yeah, but there is an argument which I'm vaguely sympathetic to, is that only. In some ways, the only society that would ever be able to do what they want to do is a private law society in some bizarre way. Because again, they don't want to do the discrimination is not allowed. You know, mass testing. And again, who gets the virus? There's so many. The whole thing is uncertainty. So it could be that the libertarian private law society with strong borders is the only society that could do what many people want them to do. And interestingly enough, Singapore, which sometimes libertarians like, sometimes socialists like, by the way, for their 99-year, and there's some rent control, there's some policies they like. Interestingly, Singapore has adopted early on a very draconian policy, from my understanding, maybe. Because this is where we get into sort of Taleb's sort of head start jump, where you jump this really early, you don't have many problems down the road. I'm somewhat sympathetic to that viewpoint. But then again, I'm not. Though for a country as large as the United States, I don't think you can do what Singapore did. But again, Singapore has lots of draconian laws. Slavoj Zizek agrees. Many of the progressive YouTubers agree. So if you want to model your society off of Singapore, go ahead. But you know, Singapore has much more conservative norms in lots of areas that most people in the United States or Britain would not at all be justified. So, but a few more comments, and then we'll finish this up.
Oh, yeah, I entirely agree. I mean, a private law society where we've all agreed that, oh, if there's a pandemic, we can forcibly test you and restrain you. Then any sort of general sort of due process or whatever simply doesn't need to apply because you've contractually waived it. I mean, yeah, I mean, you could easily do that and there'd be no general complaint because, well, you agreed to live on this sort of Covenant community in that way. So what I would say, just with the general lockdown, the way the government approached it, it's simply not been targeted at all. From all the information we have, it's that elderly people over the age of 18 with underlying health conditions. I mean, they could just have said, anybody who is over the age of like 75, you must stay indoors for 4 weeks. Anybody who is works in a hospital and come across patients, they have to self-isolate. And so does their spouse and their children. And we will inform schools about this so that you can lock off any, well, reduce to a large extent the probability of catching in hospitals. Because going to hospitals is a very bad thing, because lots of people die of catching diseases in hospital which they didn't already have. Or just
hashtag in general. Hashtag intergenics. Yes. Arm done by the healer.
And, you know, pay for doctors and nurses to go into work in taxis so they don't go in public transport. It does seem very odd that, oh, we've got this lockdown, but we've got to keep public transport going because that's essential. It's like, just carriers of this disease. Wouldn't necessarily have supported this as being forcibly, but that would have been a much more reasonable policy to pursue. But they simply didn't do that. Maybe because they didn't think it would people would abide by it, I suppose. But that would seem to be a much more reasonable way to approach it than the way they have currently approached it. Which I say, my biggest issue, it's just such a blunt policy instrument. And just with how to solve the problem of coronavirus, there is only two strategies that you can engage in. It's herd immunity and a vaccine. It's the only thing you can do. Because it will spread. It's a virus. You can't really do anything about it. So you either just have
Or just run its course and have no... and just accept the death toll, which...
Yeah. So that's herd immunity, as in, like, just let it go. I mean, the way they're trying to do it is kind of, like, slow the rate of increases. But a vaccine is going to take 18 months, probably. And the amount of economic damage would be so great.
No concerts, no church services, schools for 18 months. That's like 3% of people's lives.
and what I always think about it on an individual level. Let's suppose you're deciding whether you should go for some new drug or whatever, and you realize this drug was really expensive, and if it would keep you alive, you'd basically be like comatose, but you'd still be living. But it costs you like $100,000. It's like, well, you know what? I'd rather not live an extra 2 years. I'll take the next 3 months, and then I can bequeath the $100,000 to my children, and I can live better in the next 3 months. I mean, that's a decision lots of people would make. And a lot of people who are on the technocratic side would say, oh, yeah, that's the right decision to do, you know, because you're going to take paying about quality of life. But then they completely ignore quality of life here. And this is just social interaction, normal human experience. It's not about, because what they'll try to do is, oh, you're just trying to protect the big corporations. It was like, no.
The big corporations are open. Big corporations are open. Boeing's open.
Yeah, because they claim that they have essential customers. And so they can keep all things going. I mean, this is the problem. They'll turn around, oh, you want to scare the corporations. It's like, no, I don't particularly care about the corporations. What I care about is regular people living their regular lives and being deprived. My mother is really annoyed. She can't see anybody. She's only like 64. But like, you can't go out very much to see anybody. Church is closed. And like, she's just stuck inside all the time.
That makes two of us here with both annoyed parents. So we've been going for about an hour, and we've identified most of the aims. So thanks for doing this with us. I think it's been very insightful. I hope this has been therapeutic. It's been therapeutic for me because it's quite frustrating. Do you have any final comments?
No, not really, except end the lockdown tomorrow.
Yes, well, this is Tim Patton, and... that's my co-host Swithin signing off on our first episode of Mind Crime Liberty Podcast, and we should be back next week. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Crime.
If you would like to provide any feedback on the show, including ideas for future discussions, we would love to hear from you. Please send emails to mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That is mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.